Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we're focusing on a filmmaker whose work really defined action cinema for, well, half a century. Yet, his name, it often kind of resides in the shadow of some of his contemporaries.
Right.
We are talking about Walter Hill. He's the architect of these gritty, stylish classics like The Warriors, 48 Achers, and maybe the guy who, more than anyone else, really structurally shaped the whole Alien franchise.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Hill is just a magnificent study in artistic singularity. He's one of those rare directors in modern Hollywood who stayed, you know, uncompromisingly loyal to a specific aesthetic. Even when that aesthetic led to, well, some colossal box office failures, he's kind of the quiet master, you know? His films seem simple, but they're relentlessly intense.
Deceptively simple, yeah. And the key thing we're unpacking today, the thesis that seems to govern his whole career, it comes from Hill himself. He stated quite clearly that every film I've done has been a Western.
And that's the crucial lens, isn't it? What's fascinating is his definition of a Western. It has almost nothing to do with horses or, you know, six-shooters.
Right.
He sees the Western as fundamentally a stripped-down moral universe.
Mm.
He means a world where the conflicts, the problems, they exist beyond the normal avenues of social control. It's about what happens when the rules break down.
Okay, so that sets our mission statement for this deep dive. We're going to look at his biography, his films, his interviews, his own notes, really, to trace how this this moral universe evolved.
Mm.
Whether he's directing a buddy cop film set in the 80s or, you know, an actual historical Western, that structural framework, it stays the same.
It really does.
It's a journey into how this unique writing style, this relentless focus on genre, allowed one filmmaker to navigate, well, the really volatile landscape of Hollywood. He generated massive hits and also some truly controversial but maybe magnificent failures, too.
And that longevity that's really relevant for you, the listener, he'll prove that sticking to your guns, genre purity, a clear artistic voice, even one that sometimes tanks commercially, can keep you working.
Yeah.
And eventually, it can earn you the highest honors.
Yeah.
We're talking Emmy wins, the Writers Guild's Laurel Award. It's quite the career arc.
Okay, so let's unpack this. Let's start right at the foundation. His early life. Walter Hill, born January 10th, 1942, Long Beach, California. How does a young kid from California end up with this intense focus on, like, solitary narrative?
Well, it starts, ironically, with his health.
Mm-hmm.
Hill had severe, really crippling asthma as a child.
Right.
It was so bad he actually missed several years of school. And this wasn't just physical. You know, it created this kind of enforced solitude, intellectual, imaginative solitude.
So he spent a lot of time alone. He said it himself, didn't he? That the asthma made him profoundly comfortable being alone. And that led to, his words, a tremendous amount of reading at an early age. He wasn't getting stimulation from playing with other kids. He was getting it from stories.
Exactly. He read constantly, listened obsessively to the radio, became, and this is his phrase, utterly besotted with daytime serials. He realized this solitude let him live in this imaginary world. He got comfortable with abstract ideas dominated by stories, narrative, and characters.
Mm.
And that comfort with abstraction, that singular focus, that becomes the absolute defining feature of his screenwriting later on. So lean, so archetype-driven.
And that solitary nature, it shaped his early film taste, too, which is pretty revealing. He liked adventure films, westerns, musicals, things with clear structure, clear morality.
Right.
But he explicitly disliked kid movies. Seems like he rejected sentimentality in favor of pure drama even then. The very first film he remembers seeing, Song of the South, the Disney one from 46. Controversial now, but that was his first memory.
And you also can't ignore the blue-collar roots, the family background. That grounded him in a world of physical work, of stoicism.
Oh, okay.
And that feeds directly into the kinds of heroes he champions later. You know, the working-class guy who relies on skill, not talk.
Mm.
His paternal grandfather was a wildcat oil driller. His father supervised at Douglas Aircraft.
And he admired them. He called them smart, physical men who worked with their heads and their hands. And he didn't just, like, admire it from afar. He lived it. During high school and college, he actually worked on the oil fields on Signal Hill as a roustabout.
Yeah, tough work.
He also ran an asbestos pipe cutting machine, worked as a spray painter. These are intensely physical, manual jobs.
That physicality gave him a certain grounding, for sure. But his ambition, it was artistic. He actually thought about being a comic book illustrator for a bit. Studied art down at the Universidad de las Americas in Mexico City.
Mexico City, why there?
He said it was as far away as I could get without any money. That kind of practical, decisive choice, wanting distance, independence. That feels very Walter Hill, doesn't it?
It does. But the academic path, that shifted eventually. He majored in history at Michigan State. Seems like a bit of a detour, but maybe not. This is where his writing philosophy starts to form, apparently heavily influenced by literary figures, especially Hemingway.
Oh, the Hemingway influence is huge. He wasn't just reading him for pleasure. He was studying the prose. He wanted to write clearly and simply and make your point in an elegant way.
Clarity, simplicity, elegance.
Exactly. That's the intellectual foundation for the whole haiku style that would make him famous later. It's all about stripping narrative down to its absolute bare essentials.
So he graduates, can't join the army because of the asthma, suddenly has to figure out, okay, how do I make a living telling stories? Heads to Hollywood. What was the plan?
Well, he took the traditional route, the gritty way in. Started doing research for historical documentaries, and then crucially, he took that classic Hollywood advice. Get a job in the mailroom.
Right, the mailroom at Universal.
Yeah, someone told him it was a good way to meet people. He wasn't expecting a handout. He was just trying to work his way into the system.
And from the mailroom, he gets into the Directors Guild of America training program, which sounds pretty demanding. That was his real film school, right? An apprenticeship on high-pressure TV sets in the late 60s.
Absolutely. He was an apprentice assistant director. Observing and working on the bedrock of American genre TV. We're talking Gunsmoke, Bonanza, the Wild Wild West.
Wow.
He was learning, hands-on, the economy of storytelling you need for TV. Yeah. Efficiency, clarity, it's a perfect match for that Hemingway-inspired approach he was developing.
And he moved to features pretty quickly. Second assistant director on the Thomas Crown Affair in 68, then uncredited, second AD on Bullet, also 68.
That Bullet job, that gives you a real sense of the adrenaline and chaos he was seeing firsthand. His job was logistics, setting background for the street shots, coordinating with the police, making sure nobody got hurt during those high-speed chases. He admitted he was scared to death during every single shot.
So you've got this academic guy, the history major, raised on quiet reading, suddenly thrown into the middle of a massive San Francisco car chase, genuinely terrified. You have to wonder how much of that raw adrenaline, the calculation of risk, fed into how he wrote action later.
Oh, definitely. That experience must have cemented the difference between writing about action and filming it. He learned action isn't abstract. It's logistics. It's risk. It's immediate consequences. But here's the interesting part. Even with that invaluable experience, he didn't want to be an assistant director long term.
Really?
Yeah, he said he wanted to work and be around film, sure. But he didn't have a shred of desire to keep being an AD. His focus was always on writing and directing his own stuff.
Okay, so that's the key transition. He's doing this grueling AD work, but he's also spending, what, 4 or 5 years writing screenplays at night? His first attempts, he said, were too personal and terrible. What was the click? What shifted him from writing terrible scripts to finding success?
Structure. Yeah. It was all about structure. He realized success wasn't going to come from navel gazing, but from imposing a clear, rigid framework. The light bulb moment came when he started writing within genre films, working in a more structured narrative environment. He understood the rules of the Western, the noir, the crime thriller. Mm. And that structure gave him the discipline his writing needed.
And once he found that genre focus, things moved fast. His first proper Western script, Lloyd Williams and His Brother, it got optioned right away. Never made, but still.
Right.
But the big break, the one that really launched him, was The Getaway in 1972.
Yeah, he was brought in to co-write it. Then Peter Bogdanovich got fired. Yeah. Sam Peckinpah came in. Hill saw his chance. Basically rewrote the entire script from scratch in like 6 weeks to fit Peckinpah. Intense pressure.
And he called that specific draft far and away the best one of the films he'd written. It's massive success with Steve McQueen and Peckinpah. He said, that was really how I got to be a director. It proved he could deliver pure genre under fire.
But that screenwriting phase also taught him some hard lessons about compromise. Like in 73, he wrote The Macintosh Man, basically just to settle a lawsuit with Warner Bros.
Ouch.
He was pretty blunt about it. Admitted he wrote a quick script, wasn't very good, said he never even saw the final film, heard it was a real bomb.
That must have been a harsh intro to the reality of being a writer in Hollywood. Your words are just the starting point. And we see it again on The Drowning Pool for Paul Newman, right? He figured only maybe 2 scenes of his original script survived in the final 75 film.
Exactly. And that experience, seeing his carefully crafted work get diluted or just thrown out by the studio machine, probably reinforced his instinct to make his writing as lean and essential as possible.
Right. Like, if they're going to mess with it anyway,
I might as well just give him the absolute spine, the core structure. Much harder to break that.
So connecting this back to his love of simplicity, the screenwriting struggle, it really forged his style. It wasn't just what he wrote, but the revolutionary how. Which brings us to the defining thing about his aesthetic. The spare universe, that haiku approach.
Yes. And the specific catalyst for this was reading Alexander Jacob's screenplay for John Borman's Point Blank. Hill said reading that script was an absolute revelation. Just showed him how little you actually needed to write to convey huge amounts of drama and action.
And he just ran with it, developed this extremely spare, almost haiku style, for stage directions and dialogue. Applied it ruthlessly, Hard Times, The Driver, The Warriors, and famously that uncredited rewrite of Aliens.
And just so people understand what that means for a script, a typical writer might put, he pauses, thinking about his past mistakes and the challenge ahead before slowly, deliberately picking up the gun.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Hill, using his haiku style, would probably write something like, he stops, waits, picks up the gun. Maybe three lines max.
The genius there is it forces the director, the actor, everyone to internalize the emotion. There's no description of the feeling. The feeling comes purely from the action, the character's position in the scene. It's pure genre. Movement, consequence, not psychology.
And speaking of massive influence,
yeah,
the Alien franchise. And that's a great sort of uncredited story of Walter Hill's writing career. He co-founded Brandywine Productions with David Gillern and Gordon Carroll. They essentially built the engine for one of sci-fi's biggest IPs.
Brandywine optioned the original Alien script, which was basically kind of a B-movie monster flick, right?
Pretty much. Hill and Giller rewrote it, fundamentally. Now, they didn't get writing credit because of some WGA arbitration thing, but they got producer credits, and their structural changes were absolutely monumental.
What were the key changes?
They moved it from being just monster runs loose on spaceship to a really tense, character-driven survival story. And crucially, they made Ripley the main hero.
Ah.
The original script had several male leads kind of competing. Hill and Giller streamlined the cast, elevated Ripley, made her the backbone. They applied that sparse haiku style to action horror. And the tension, it comes precisely from that economy, what you don't see, what you don't know.
And the impact was huge and lasted. John Hughes, right, the famous screenwriter, later said he only really understood screenwriting after reading Hill's version of the Alien script. That one document basically redefined action horror structure.
And Hill's involvement through Brandywine has been consistent ever since.
Yeah.
Which shows his business sense, too. He was story executive producer on Aliens in 86, writer-producer on Alien 3 in 92. He stayed on as a producer for every entry since, Prometheus, the upcoming stuff. He's this uncredited sci-fi giant who made his directing name elsewhere.
So after proving himself as this powerhouse writer, he finally gets his shot behind the camera, met producer Lawrence Gordon in 73, struck a deal, write a script, direct it for scale. That gave us his directorial debut, Hard Times, 1975.
And Hard Times was the perfect first film for him. It embodied his philosophy. Made fast, made cheap 38 days, just $2.7 million on location in New Orleans. Stars James Coburn, Charles Bronson. It's about illegal street fighting in the Depression.
It's a pure Western, isn't it?
Totally. Two strangers roll into town. One has a code, one has a talent. They operate outside the law. Classic setup.
What's amazing is, even after that successful debut, he stayed fiercely protective of his vision. He got offered The Shootist, which would have meant directing John Wayne. But he turned it down. Why? Simply because he didn't like the script. He wouldn't compromise his aesthetic, not even for the Duke.
That takes guts. And he also dipped his toe into TV around then, which had this kind of hidden legacy. He created a series called Dog and Cat in 77. But he got so mad when they rewrote his pilot script that he took his name off it, used a pseudonym.
But here's the kicker. That original pilot script for Dog and Cat, the one he hated because they changed it, it had that spare buddy cop dynamic he had basically codified. And years later, it influenced Shane Black when he wrote the original script for Lethal Weapon.
No kidding.
Yeah. Proves the strength of Hill's structural DNA even when he himself disowned the final product.
Okay, so after that fairly strong start, Hill's career hits that infamous late 70s roller coaster.
Mm.
Let's talk about his second film, The Driver from 78. Maybe the purest expression of his Western idea in a modern setting.
It is utterly, utterly uncompromising. Characters with no names. The driver, the detective, they're just their functions, their archetypes. It's so lean, it's almost abstract art. He wanted Steve McQueen originally, but McQueen passed.
I think commercially.
Yeah.
A total disaster in the U.S. Hill himself said the film made exactly $0 domestically.
Zero.
$0. That's fatal.
Should have been. He genuinely thought his career might be over. Said if he hadn't already been shooting his next movie, it might have ended right there.
Why do you think he went so abstract, so stylized? Knowing the commercial risk had to be huge, was it just for the satisfaction of boiling the genre down to its absolute essence?
I think it was a test of his whole philosophy. Could the Western idea survive with literally nothing left but the conflict between two professionals, the lawman and the outlaw? American audiences in 78? Nope. Too pure. But the paradox is, it was huge overseas, and later, massive cult film.
Right.
He even noted that when they do retrospectives of his work now, The Driver's often the first film they show. He trusted the aesthetic would win out eventually. And he only survived the immediate fallout because he'd already secured financing for the next one, The Warriors, by promising to make it very cheaply.
And The Warriors, 1979, that's the quintessential urban Western raid.
Yeah.
A gang, the protagonists, have to cross hostile territory, the boroughs of New York, fighting off rival gangs, these other outlaw clans, just to get back to their home turf.
It's the Western journey framework overlaid onto contemporary New York. Brilliant.
Yeah. But the film became this cultural flashpoint, steeped in controversy.
Yeah.
When it came out, there were actual shootings, some killings at screenings, often gang-related incidents. Paramount got spooked, pulled all the radio and TV ads.
That must have sent shockwaves through Hollywood.
It did. Studios got terrified about releasing intense urban action films for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But Hill, very pragmatically, noted the bottom line. Hollywood forgives a lot when you have a hit.
Mm.
And The Warriors was a hit. Critics who got the style loved it. Box office trumped the scandal, ultimately.
Okay, so after those contemporary urban westerns, he finally makes his first true historical western with the Long Riders in 1980.
Yeah, structurally, this one's fascinating. It's about the James Younger gang. And the casting gimmick is genius.
What?
He cast real-life acting brothers, the Keeches, the Carradines, the Quaids, the Guests, to play the historical outlaw brothers.
Oh, right.
That immediately reinforces the themes of loyalty, family, clan structure. It echoes that Western code. Hill said his own code for the film was simple. Keep the jokes funny and the bullets real.
He followed that up with another film that got critical praise, but was, again, a commercial catastrophe.
Right.
Southern Comfort in 1981.
Yeah.
Intense thriller, National Guardsmen lost in the Louisiana Bayou battling Cajuns.
Hill rewrote that script with David Giller, turned it into this tight existential thriller. A lot of people saw it as a Vietnam allegory.
Mm-hmm.
Hill denied that specific intent. It was just about, you know, men pushed beyond social control again. But the commercial failure was brutal. Hill lamented, it didn't make a nickel anywhere, foreign, domestic, anything. It was a universal audience failure.
So we're seeing a definite pattern here. Artistic purity, like The Driver and Southern Comfort, often equals financial failure. By the early 80s, despite his talent and this growing cult reputation, Hill must have been commercially on thin ice.
Exactly. And this is where timing and necessity kind of collide.
Yeah.
The writer's strike ended. Hollywood needed projects fast. Producer Larry Gordon apparently dusted off a script that had been shuttling around development for years.
Mm-hmm.
That script was 48 H's Hill. And the studio jumped on it, put it together really quickly.
The casting for 48 H's in 82, that was just lightning in a bottle. Nick Nolte was already attached. And Hill's girlfriend at the time, a talent agent, suggested this young comedian from Saturday Night Live, Eddie Murphy.
Yeah. That pairing, the gritty veteran character actor and the explosive, completely fresh comedic talent, it basically defined the modern buddy cop movie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the shoot itself was apparently pretty rough. Clashes between Hill, the studio, Nolte, Murphy, volatile mix. But the result? Massive industry-changing box office hit. It took that mismatched partners trope, already a staple, and supercharged it with Hill's Western structure. Two guys, cop and criminal, forced to team up in that moral gray zone where the system has failed.
And that success gave him the clout to make his really stylish, really specific rock and roll fable, Streets of Fire, in 1984. Set in this fictional, hyper-stylized city, an attempt to mash up the purest elements of the musical and the Western.
And unlike The Driver, Streets of Fire bombed initially at the box office, but almost immediately it gained this incredibly passionate cult following. It fits the pattern. Hill chases his pure aesthetic vision, risks initial rejection, but achieves lasting, genre-defining style.
Then came the big anomaly. The one he openly admitted was just about the money. Brewster's Millions in 1985, his first and only straight-up comedy. Made, in his own words, to improve his bank account and success quotient.
How do we square that? Hill, the auteur, the genre purist, the Hemingway disciple, taking on a broad comedy remake. Was that just a necessary compromise to fund the next passion project?
Seems like it. He called it an aberration in the career line. A necessary one, maybe. It was profitable. And it let him pivot right back to action with Red Heat in 1988. That paired Arnold Schwarzenegger playing this stoic Soviet cop, perfect hill archetype, all physical presence, with Jim Belushi as the wisecracking American.
Red Heat made money, showed he could handle huge stars and budgets, but it was actually a bit of a box office disappointment for that peak Schwarzenegger era. This period also saw him flexing his producer muscles, right? He was involved with the Tales from the Crypt TV show.
Yeah, executive producer and directed some episodes, kept his hand in different pots. But it's clear, by the end of the 80s, he was still shaping genre cinema, even if his purest westerns weren't always connecting commercially. Oh, and we have to mention his biggest commercial hit, the only sequel he directed.
Right. Another 48 HRs in 1990. Critics mostly saw it as just a retread of the first one, kind of tired. But financially, it was his highest grossing film ever. Pulled in $153.5 million worldwide. Just goes to show, in Hollywood, sometimes revisiting past glories, even if creatively maybe less exciting, is the most bankable move.
Okay, moving into the 90s. The roller coaster ride continues, maybe gets even bumpier. He directed Trespass in 1992, but its release got really complicated because the 92 LA riots happened right before it was supposed to come out.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
The studio had to delay it, change the title, shows how real world events can just derail everything.
And then he went back hard to his obsession, historical westerns, with unfortunately pretty mixed results again. Geronimo, An American Legend in 93 and Wild Bill in 95. Both got kind of middling reviews, didn't do well commercially. It seemed like audiences just weren't biting on the kind of unvarnished, authentic westerns he wanted to make.
And that failure led to some pretty candid reflections from him. He admitted in 95 that his style, where, as he put it, bullets are real, characters operate in a grounded, dramatic world, was feeling slightly out of step with the big trend towards oversized kind of cartoon action movies.
He was basically lamenting the shift away from serious realistic action towards hyper-stylized, physics-defying spectacle. He was a classicist stuck in the emerging blockbuster culture of the late 90s.
He tried to recapture that pure aesthetic with Last Man Standing in 96, starring Bruce Willis, a very direct return to his roots, Prohibition-era Western update of Yojimbo, which itself came from Dashiell Hammett's Red Harvest, back to that sparse, gritty style. But again, audiences just didn't really connect.
But the real low point, the absolute professional catastrophe that nearly ended things for him, was Supernova in 2000. His conflict with MGM over his vision for that sci-fi film got so bad that they brought in Francis Ford Coppola to recut the entire movie.
Coppola, wow. That's a major intervention.
Huge. And incredibly demoralizing for Hill. He withdrew completely, took his name off it, used the pseudonym Thomas Lee, a variation on the industry's Alan Smithy distress signal. He said his original cut was much darker. The whole experience made him think about quitting.
After decades of grinding to have your vision totally hijacked like that.
Yeah, I could see how that would make you want to walk away.
He did recover, directed the prison boxing movie Undisputed in 2002. But what's truly fascinating is what happened next. He found this incredible, immediate acclaim and recognition, not in feature films, but in prestige television, proving his mastery was still there, maybe just needed a different screen at that moment.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting. 2004, Hill directs the pilot episode for HBO's Western drama, Deadwood. Think about the irony. A decade after his big screen Westerns flopped, he wins the Primetime Emmy for Outstanding Directing for a Drama Series and a DGA Award just for that one pilot episode. It was stunning validation, wasn't it? Almost instant proof of his mastery of the genre, his ability to establish that stripped-down moral universe with incredible efficiency.
Yeah.
The quality was undeniable, however. Classic Hill conflict here, too. Despite the wins, he apparently had a major falling out with the show's creator, David Milch, during the editing of that pilot. Never worked on another episode? Seems like it was a clash of two very strong, uncompromising artistic visions.
But the TV awards kept coming. In 2006, he directed the Western miniseries Broken Trail. Huge audience success. Became the highest-rated original movie on cable at the time.
And again, swept the awards. Won another DGA Award for directing and the Primetime Emmy for Outstanding Limited Series. It just cemented his legacy as the master of the Western form, regardless of screen size. The genre had migrated to premium TV, and he followed it there and triumphed.
So by the 2010s, he sort of described himself as semi-retired. Noted pretty pragmatically that the desirability of hiring directors over 60 is fairly diminished. Took a bit of a break, but then Sylvester Stallone pulled him back to direct Bullet to the Head in 2012.
He never really stopped working, though, did he? That commitment to narrative is deep. He published a graphic novel, Trigger Man. And then, incredibly, at age 77, he wrote and performed a spoken word record, The Cowboy Iliad. A legend told in the spoken word, telling the story of an 1871 Kansas shootout.
A spoken word record. That's dedication.
That's pure, lifelong obsession with the Western genre, taken to its logical, literary extreme.
And his most recent feature film work feels like a fitting return. Directed The Western Dead for a dollar in 2022, got the Glory to the Filmmaker Award at the Venice Film Festival for it, and professionally, he was honored with the Writers Guild's 2024 Laurel Award for Screenwriting Achievement, celebrating that whole career built on the haiku style.
His whole career just reveals this unwavering commitment to one core vision. And now, he's apparently planning his next project. Says he's going back to film noir, which is, you know, basically the urban western's closest cousin. Confirms that his moral universe, it just keeps operating within those genre lines.
So if we boil it all down, synthesize his career, what we see is a filmmaker who really defined modern action cinema, produced one of the biggest sci-fi franchises ever, won multiple Emmys, all while operating under this one guiding principle, the Western. His whole aesthetic, defined by that spare haiku style, valuing clarity, physical action, moral conflict above everything else.
And he survived Hollywood by being completely, uncompromisingly clear about his interests. Those big commercial failures like The Driver making literally $0 domestically, they were ultimately redeemed, weren't they? By cult status, by later critical appreciation, by award recognition in unexpected places like TV. It proved his vision wasn't wrong, maybe just ahead of its time, or needed the right format.
Let's end with that really pragmatic view he has of the industry, that perspective of the working pro who knows the score. We come to the arena uncalled to seek our fortune and hazard disgrace. That's the game. Those are the rules. Such a hard-boiled, perfect philosophy for surviving in that world.
Yeah. And it raises a really interesting question for you, the listener, to think about, especially looking at Hollywood right now. Hill was willing to risk absolute commercial failure. The Driver, Southern Comfort, chasing his specific moral and aesthetic vision. Given the intense commercial pressures today, where studios rarely tolerate anything but immediate massive success, what does the uncompromising longevity of someone like Hill tell us? Someone who valued clarity and genre purity over market trends. What does that say about survival in the film industry?
Right.
How many filmmakers working today would genuinely risk making a film that could yield, like a Driver did, exactly $0 domestically, just for the sake of stylistic purity? The answer to that, well, it might be the difference between a long, unique career like Hill's and maybe a shorter, more conventional one.